Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to Now Where Were We? I'm Bob Cryer. And today, Dad and I are meeting up for a well-deserved pint with the actor, writer, and presenter, Sanjeev Bhaskar. Dad's a huge fan of Sanjeev's work in Goodness Gracious Me and The Kumars at Number 42, although for my kids, and indeed myself, it's his appearance in Paddington 2 and the way he says the word bottoms that seals his place in the comedy pantheon. The first thing we wanted to know was how Sanjeev felt when the word chuddies, which he popularised in one of his catchphrases, made its way into the Oxford English Dictionary.
How did that come about?
Well,
did you actually lobby?
No,
the OED? I mean,
no. It was. It would be great if you could actually find a pressure group to get a word into the dictionary. It was, goodness gracious me, there were a couple of characters that I wrote and one of which I performed on that, and I wanted, and they were kind of Asian kids who were kind of street kids that I saw a lot of around that time. You know, like the type that they just put the in it at the end of the sentence, in it. For no real reason, but it's emphasis. That's why. And I was looking for a phrase that meant or that could mean, oh my goodness, or go away, or, you know, up yours, or, you know, one of those things, an emphatic phrase of some kind that was new and to them. And at the time, The Simpsons was kind of recently started, I suppose. And Bart Simpson had a phrase which was kiss my shorts.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what, rhythmically, that's really good. There's a good rhythm to that, that those three beats are quite good. So kiss my chuddies became, and chuddies are underpants. And through repetition then, and it being used in, you know, other references, It's the
playground zeitgeist, isn't it? It's when the young ones came out and everyone was, you know, doing Rickisms.
Yeah, right.
Have you had that experience of becoming part of the zeitgeist, Father?
Not to my knowledge, no.
that was the thing about the Far Show. It said, well, let's just do all catchphrases, you know, to a greater or lesser extent.
They did that as a joke item for an awards or something, and somebody said, you could do this. They hadn't thought of doing it as an actual series, you know, and they did it as a joke bit for an award or something. And that was great.
But with Kenny Everett, it's all done with the best possible taste.
Yeah.
Became something close to a repeated thing in the playground.
His instinct, crossing his legs violently when he said that, he remembered a drag act from years ago, Old Mother Riley, who used to cross her legs forcefully when she was speaking. It's weird looking back, Everett remembering a drag act he knew when he was a kid. Oh, she used to instinctively, I'll cross my legs when I say it, best possible taste, you know.
But the whole thing, it's interesting, that whole thing with catchphrases, because they go back to the beginning of, certainly of sound, don't they? I mean, you know, here's another fine mess you got me into.
Yes.
Became a catchphrase. That was something that was repeated. That
yeah.
Became the title of one of their films as well, you know. So that familiarity is something that
another I guess makes, nice mess, incidentally.
Another nice mess.
Not fine.
How did it become fine?
Yeah. It was misquoted. I've often said fine, and it's been checked out. The original is nice mess.
Oh, well, there you go.
Isn't that fascinating and deadly dull?
Yeah, no, it's brilliant.
I've got a friend who loves misquoting famous lines.
Oh, right.
Rufus, if you're listening. And it's, you know, it's all things like, this is the start of a beautiful partnership, you know.
Things
like that. It's just, where we're going, we don't need to ride in a car.
Yeah.
Just to really annoy the pedants.
I was watching 12 Angry Men about the jury, You know, and they're arguing, and one of the characters is very forcefully, he don't even speak proper English. And the guy next to him said, he doesn't even speak proper English. I thought, a lovely little moment
in
the film.
In the film?
Yes, I'd never spotted that moment. Oh, it's great. Oh, and David Renwick, a friend, rebuked a man once and said, you and your pedanticism. And the man said, pedantry. And David said, oh, yes.
I'm just talking about those kind of early films. So Laurel and Hardy remain one of my favourites, actually, I have to say. And it's something about that combination of the relationship and pricking pomposity and breaking the fourth wall as well.
Really, that's right.
But what were yours, Barry? When you did you go back to them? How did you discover that era of comedy? A lot of people said Marx Brothers.
Brothers for me, because I can't be objective about it, but the Marx Brothers don't seem to date to this day if you see them. I mean, that early film Duck Soup, which is about a war, is superb.
That's phenomenal, isn't it?
And they were visual as well as verbal. They had the clearly defined characters.
Were you always Groucho first, or did you sort of warm to them all in
equal
measure?
I warmed to them all, and yes, and they had their well-defined rules. I mean, Harpo was verbal in their early days on the stage, but then they decided that with his face, it'd be funny if he was the one who didn't speak. He sort of evolved through time, you know.
What I love about Zeppo is that he did a very good Groucho. And that he would often deputize. And so again, he was someone, for the sake of the team, he took a bullet because he would, you know, he was the sort of matinee idol looking one who did
the
song.
He was a straight man
in there.
Got the
girl and all of that. But he had the chops to do a Groucho.
Yeah. If he wanted. There's those great stories as well where Chico would go and shag some girl after a show or something wearing Harpo's wig. They looked alike enough. And of course he didn't have to say anything.
No. That's wonderful.
What was he? He was kissing a chorus girl, wasn't it? And his wife showed up.
Yeah.
And he said, I was whispering in her mouth.
Oh God. Jack Benny, an idol who I did meet and write for, he was a young comedian and he was on the bill. He told me this. He was on the bill with the great Marx Brothers. He was, you know. And of course they were physical, verbal, capering about the stage, doing their sketches. And he thought, I'm a young comic here. And he said, I can't believe it looking back. I'll be different. I'll be slow and quiet. And he said, it was really tough when I was starting as a young comic, being slow and quiet. But he held on to it. And that man's pauses were wonderful. He'd get a laugh at a pause and just his reaction.
He's done that fantastic thing once, didn't he, when he said, you know, people say that I could be funny reading out the phone book. Well, let's find out. Yeah. And he did. And everyone, because it was the pauses and the waiting of the thing. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, they said about the speed, and you say that gives you longevity. And that was always the thing with Phil Silvers, who was, you know, as he got older, he became a very different kind of performer because he couldn't handle the pace anymore. Whereas Jack Benny just got slower, if anything.
They were doing... We were working on the Des O'Connor show. Benny Hill had been a big hit in America and they're trying to, you know, launch Des in America. And the people I met, the performers who came over to do it, including Jack Benny, I thought, I'm meeting Jack Benny. And he was so polite and quiet and we all liked the guy, remembered everybody's name. And... one day he said, Ronnie Cass, I was working with, I remember, who was a musician as well, obviously. And one day Jack Benny said very politely, I've had an idea. You've got a set of a clothing shop, and I pick up this tie and look at it. And then the guy behind the counter tells me how much it costs. What do you think? And we said, oh, boy, this is embarrassing. What did we say? Oh, and the director gave us a wink as if, well, we can shoot it anyway, you know, indulge the man. And I forgot the name of the actor behind, Jimmy Villiers. He was in the show anyway, but he played the man behind the counter. And Jack Benny came in and, good morning, morning, and went to a tie rack and picked up a tie and looked at another tie. And then he took one tie to Jimmy Villiers and said, how much is this? And Jimmy Villiers told him. And Jack Benny was stunned and just turned and looked at the camera, and the audience laughed. Mm. And we thought, masterclass.
Yeah.
He knew. Des O'Connor said, nobody's watching me. He said, if you're in a sketch with Jack Benny, he said, you look at his reaction to every... He's getting the laughs. He said, I'm delighted to be working with him.
Was it the same show that you said you got to stand with him in the edit suite?
That's right. We'd done a bit where he was just fourth wall talking to the camera, to, and we never got it done. John Scofield, the producer, said, oh, God, we never got that done. So he said to Jack, you're flying home tomorrow. And Jack Benny said, yeah. I'm flying in the morning. And John Scofield said, we never got that bit done, Jack, did we? I could fly in the afternoon. Never forgot that. Mm. So I'm with him in a deserted studio. There's a man going to put canned laughter on it. And Jack Benny, there's just him and me and the cameraman. He does this 3-minute bit with very strange pauses. We then go into the booth or whatever to talk to the man who's putting the laughs on. And this guy said to me later, that was a masterclass. He said, most comics would say, laugh there after the joke. He'd say, you stopped in the middle of that line, Jack. Yes, they've just realised what I said before. And with respect, he said, that's not a great joke, so don't put a big laugh on it. And the man who was doing it, afterwards, he said, that was just amazing. He said, you put it together. And it was edited into the show, and you couldn't tell the difference of him with the audience on the night and the bit we'd shot the next morning. He was in awe of him, this sound man. He said, nobody had done it for us as brilliant as that, he said. Stopping in the middle of a line because they've just realised what I said before.
That's supremely confident, isn't
it?
Yeah. It's really knowing.
But also heart, so well honed on the circuit.
Yeah. Yes.
You, you're talking about the silent movie heroes of yours. You both have the Bristol Slapstick Festival in common. And that was something that I seem to remember growing up with. Harold Lloyd was on a Tuesday night, sort of at 6 o'clock, that we played. It seems weird to think during the 70s, early 80s, that was something that was regularly coming into British homes. Whereas I would say Jack Benny was largely, not unknown, but to our generation, perhaps, was someone you discovered a bit later on.
Yeah. I mean, Jack Benny was never kind of a TV star in Britain.
No.
You know, he obviously had his radio career and his TV career in America. So I think unless you were interested in comedy, then you found out about these guys.
But otherwise, to be growing up now where everything is available. And so people's tastes in comedy are transatlantic, they're global,
it can all be found. But the difference is, I think that, you know, TV is still, you know, people still will, for certain programs, you know, gather together to watch it. They won't gather around a laptop or a phone or something. And, you know, I remember as a kid, the best thing about the school holidays was that starting at sort of 9 o'clock on BBC Two in the morning, you'd have kind of 3 or 4 hours of, you know, Chaplin and Keaton and Harold Lloyd and Laurel and Hardy. And then you'd have, you know, It Happened One Night or something. Like, you'd have all these.
Yeah.
And as a kind of education in terms of, purely in terms of comedy, what you get is the kind of genealogy of comedy. You don't get the end result. You get that stuff, and then, you know, in the afternoon, in the evening, there'd be kind of the two Ronnies or, you know, Kenny Everett in the evening or Python or whatever. And across that, you know, those summer holidays or even across that day, you'd sort of get the full kind of cycle. Whereas now, if you're interested, of course you can go and find it, but you have to go on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's there. But or Bilko, which I think is genius and ahead of its time. Just in terms of the pace of it, it's extraordinary. And that was, you know, that was on the telly. And so it was there. And you could watch it on your own, but chances were that other members of your family would be there or someone who dropped in was there. And so it became a part of your life in a way that is...
Yes.
in a way that, you know, watching things on YouTube isn't, because it's yeah. you and a small
which screen. Has that element of discovery that I think I remember Conan O'Brien talking about SCTV, you know, the Martin Short, Eugene yeah. Levy,
yeah.
Catherine O'Hara show that was sort of a cousin, Canadian cousin of SNL, mm. Saturday Night Live. And he said where he lived in sort of upstate, I think he grew up near Boston, but just north of there. And he said it was the way he had to put his aerial on top of a cupboard in order to get mm-hmm. a Canadian TV station that was playing it. So that was their element of discovery.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, what you're saying is sort of that happens to people on laptops, but the shared experience of the family show, where, you know, comedy is obviously something to be shared, that was something that radio, where you gather around the radio and listen to.
Yeah, well, can you ever refer to this as well? When the recorders came in, you know, and you could record a program, and Everett said, you know, somebody's got one of these, because you say to them, did you see that program last night? And they say, not yet.
yeah. yeah.
Because it was communal in those days. You couldn't record a program. So the family would gather round to watch a program or listen to a radio show. And I think it's sad that went, really, the communal viewing and listening was,
I think particularly with comedy, because it's, yes. I mean, whether it's, you know, films, whether it's theatre, whether it's, you know, live, it's that shared experience.
Yeah, you shared and you're laughing together. You're the little audience there, yeah.
And there's something about also an audience discovering that moment together that connects
yes.
all of you.
Yeah.
You know, which is quite unique in that, I suppose, you know, I'm trying to think of equivalents, but I guess in horror films, it's the group scare. Mm. You know, there's suddenly you're all connected because you all went at the same
yes,
time.
Yes, that's right.
And that can only be, I mean, you know, you feel like a twit on your own if you're going at a horror film. Do you know what I mean?
No, that communal audience thing. Yes, that's what it's about.
I was curious, actually, there were two questions that came into my head at the same time. So this will be the first one, which was, for you guys, what was the communal TV shows for the family? What were the programs that you all kind of went, okay, let's all gather around to watch this?
There was only me and my mum. My dad had died and my brother was away. I'm trying to remember what my mother and I used to watch. Oh, that, good gracious. We didn't have a television set for a long time. She got rid of it for some reason, and I can't remember.
Oh, you had it and it went?
Yes.
Stealing all the laughs, that's why.
Yes. We were listening to the wireless, as it was known, yes, listening to Tommy Handley, who was a big star in those days. Itmar, it's that man again, Itmar. Oh, boy, that was...
But when you had your own family and I came along and I was... always grateful in the fact that you're quite a Catholic viewer. You would watch all different kinds of comedy. I remember Kelly Monteith.
Yeah, I remember Kelly Monteith.
Oh, yeah. And I was a great thrill of mine. I'm the youngest of four. The great thrill of mine is obviously I've got three children myself, and I know that by the third one, by the youngest, you've given up trying to enforce any rules. So that by the time I was, you know, old enough to get the jokes that were on, I was able to sneak into your bedroom. And you would be watching, I guess, in the way a lot of people in America watch late night TV and the talk shows. And this is, in a way, connected to, God forbid, this should actually be connected to the conceit of this podcast. But, and watch again, late at night, there would very often be, there'd be a Mel Brooks movie on, there'd be stuff that was perhaps a little bit edgier than I'd be allowed to watch normally. But the great thrill was Parky.
Mm.
So that was Saturday nights, I think. Mm. And so just before Match of the Day or just after, I forget. And the thing that we were talking about when we started coming up with the idea for the podcast is that was the time when you get to look into a celebrity's life off
mm-hmm.
screen.
Mm-hmm.
So Bette Davis would be on. Mm-hmm. David Niven yes. would be on. Mm-hmm. And that would be the only chance you get.
Yeah, no, you're right. That was the thrill. And it was, I mean, I've kind of gone back and found... not just on YouTube, actually. When I was in New York, there was the Museum of Film and Television, where they had the archives of all the shows there. And going back to some of those early Tonight shows with Jack Parr and people like that.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because it's it because also I think that, you know, people who do the you know, contractual obligation PR rounds now to go on those shows are much, much well-versed at, because they're on for maybe 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And you've got to sell the thing that you're doing because that's why you're there. And
that's why it's so great. And just in the recent past, we've lost Charles Grodin and Norm MacDonald. And they were two great examples of people who went on and gave the anti-interview, didn't they?
Yeah.
They withdraw the kind of carrot from the host to have the banter.
Yeah.
And just say, I've got my lawyer on the phone just this afternoon. Or...
But that's the thing with all those early shows. There were conversations. There wasn't, they didn't feel like there was a contractual obligation to the conversation. And so they were allowed to flow. And you had the time, and so you felt that you got to know a bit about the person.
Yeah.
Yes. You know,
and that was the thing that's different. I think now you get, it's a bit like, I've always felt this, actually, you know, the internet's an amazing thing, obviously. But certainly when I was a kid, if you wanted to know something, if you're curious about something, you had to ask someone. And if they didn't know, you had to get the bus or whatever and go to the library and maybe get a book on it. And if the book wasn't in, you had to ask the librarian either when it would be back or ask for another book. You'd say, look, this is what I want to find out. Is there another? And so there was a physical journey to you finding out, for instance, that, you know, the blue whale is the largest kind of mammal in the world. And so there was a physical journey to that.
Yeah.
And along the way, chances are you learned 10 other things.
Right. Yes.
Whereas now you can just look it up and you go, what's the biggest app? And you go, blue whale.
And you're completely in the hands of the person telling you,
whether it's that,
you know, an uncle or a cousin or a friend in the playground.
Yeah.
Whereas we now just call that Wikipedia.
Yes. Yeah.
I never thought of that, Sanjeev. That journey, going to the library, opening a book, searching around, that is much more satisfying than going, oh, I must look that up, click, oh, got it.
Well, there's something, so, you know, one of my kind of various hats is being the Chancellor of the University of Sussex. And there's a story that I tell the graduates at the graduation ceremonies occasionally. And it's some ancient story about some old king, let's say Greece, ancient Greece. And the king decides that the next day they're going to move the capital. Right, and he says, right, we're moving tomorrow. So everyone's got to get out of here. Here's the other place. Off you go. And all these people kind of packed up their kind of carts and they got their horses and all the rest of it. And there were those that kind of raced off just to get the best real estate. They said, well, let's get there. We'll get the best bit and it'll be fantastic. And there were the others who plodded along and they stopped at villages and stopped at a waterfall and, you know, took in the sights. And when they all arrived at this new place, there was nothing there. It was barren. And so the only people who'd gained anything were the people who'd stopped along the way. And so that whole thing about the journey.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is everything. Yeah. You know, it's kind of, because I said, you know, even going to the library to find out, you know, which king did what, is that you inevitably look at three other books and there's other bits of information that go in. And I think it stays with you in a slightly different way. It's less disposable.
Yeah.
It's like opening a reference book, which I do quite a lot, looking up a name, but you see another name on the same page and you think, oh, yes. And then you turn to that. And I finished up checking out 7 or 8 names because I only looked up one to start with. I love the chain of connection.
Well, that's,
no, I mean, that reminds you of him, her, well,
you used to write sketches for Les Dawson with...
David Nobbs and I.
David Nobbs.
For Les, yeah. And, yeah, make connections, you know.
But although, I have to say, I mean, for that, the internet, I mean, there's almost too much information because the number of times I've disappeared down a rabbit hole where I've been looking up one thing and then it's led me to something else. It's great, fun, but actually it's still disposable.
It's the virtual equivalent of walking into a room and going, I forgot why I came in here.
Yeah, exactly. Just getting interested in something else, you know. Something else I wanted to ask both of you, actually, which I was just curious about. Who was the first famous person you met? And it may or may not be the same as who was the first hero you met.
When I was at university, briefly, and BA English failed, that's another story, I was writing for the university magazine, and Frankie Howard, was a bit of an idol of mine. In those days, a radio star. But there was the Empire Theatre in Leeds. And Frankie Howard was topping the bill. So I thought, oh, boy. So I went and left a note at the stage door, got a very quick reply. It was twice nightly, two shows a night. And he invited me along on a Friday between the two shows. And I turned up. And he met me personally at the stage door with a dog, which is neither here nor there. Then we went to his dressing room. And I thought, I can't believe it. He was the first big name I'd actually met. And I was trying to concentrate and make some notes. And we chatted away. Then he produced some embrocation and indicated his groin and said, I get these terrible pains here, but it's not the same when I rub it in. And I thought, oh, boy. And I managed to evade the issue and change the subject. And he took the rejection. And I found out he tried it on with everybody and got rejected all over.
Yes, I have to say at this point, this is well documented by quite a few people.
But yeah. It's the first time I've ever heard that Frankie Howard had effectively Schrodinger's dog. It was neither here nor there. That's extraordinary.
I don't know why I mentioned the dog,
Sandy. Well, because it's got
nothing to do with the story at all.
But that's the most incredible part of this story, because the other bit we know about.
When he arrived at the stage door with a dog, what was that about? Yeah,
which was neither here nor there. It's extraordinary.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And what about you? What was the first famous person and or hero that you...
Well,
met?
Obviously, when I was 3 days old, I met the host of Hello Cheeky, Barry Cryer, and whatever happened to him. I remember you didn't often bring... people you're working with home. That sounds quite tawdry, doesn't it?
No.
But you had a 40... Now, I think this is right. You had a 42nd birthday party. And I remember that because I think it was the age at which your father died, I think.
Yes.
And you threw a big party as if to say, well, I made it this far. Mm. And it was full of everyone you'd worked with like in the last 5 years. So my job was on car park duty. So I would sit in the window by the front door.
This, yeah.
The guests would come in and I would see if they had a car, and then I'd rush to the front door and I'd get the keys and sort of hang them on the hook. And I swear on my life that I was looking and that no one had been for a while. And then behind me, the curtain started moving and it was Eric Morecambe. Poked his head through the curtain, as I was used to seeing him on television do.
Yeah.
And there's no line attached to this and not much of a story, which is a shame. But he just went, is he here yet? And I remember I was dressed as a goalkeeper So I had the gloves on as well at the time. He didn't do a line about that either. But you said that party, he went round resolutely talking to everybody who wasn't, in quotes, a star.
Yeah.
He was always more interested in the friends of mum from the local church or friends of yours from the pub or whatever. Because he was...
And the guy in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the only time he came round, Eric?
I think the only time Eric came to the house, yes. Ernie, who lived for a while in Harrow, very close by, we saw more of in those days, yeah.
But after that, there was Vincent Price.
Oh, wow.
Came round.
I know, I couldn't believe
that.
Wow,
yeah.
No. With his agent, Arthur Marmer. And he'd been filming near to us, big house and everything, called Grimsdyke Manor. And I'd met him because he'd been guesting on the shows I was working on. And my wife had a big thing about Joseph Cotton. You just said the name and she buckled at the knees. And Vincent Price, we invited him to dinner. May I bring my agent? Arthur was looking after me. Certainly, of course. Oh, could I bring Joe Cotton? My wife. Oh. That didn't
Let alone
happen.
The fact that she was having to cook for Vincent Price, who was well known
for cookery.
As a gourmand and had a cookbook. And
Yes, and our dog left the house that night and we thought, where's he gone? The oven broke down. It was nightmare time for my darling and everything. And as you said, the man who did, he brought a cookery book for us. And later on, I am not leaving this house without that recipe. Oh, the charm of the man.
But you were working at Elstree, I think, I remember. And the biggest thrill for me was that I got, you managed to get me the autographs of Peter Mayhew, Chewbacca.
Mm.
And a man who may not be that well remembered now, but Jill Gerard, who played Buck Rogers.
Buck Rogers in the
25th century, And so to me, even though I'd met Eric Morecambe and Vincent Price, like that kind of trumped it. You, in an interview, said you have an amazingly clear memory for anecdotes.
I have an anecdotal memory.
Yeah.
So, my earliest memory is 2.5. And then after that, there are various things I remember in huge detail. I mean, how I felt as well and who was wearing what. But if it's in the form of an anecdote, then I'll remember it.
Right.
You know.
Whereas you were saying about jokes, because a lot of people love telling jokes. Mm. You say you're very keen, Dad. You say that a lot of observational comedians have jokes that they only tell off stage, or that you're surprised by musicians, especially very good joke tellers.
Yeah.
So I'm just interested in that. You saying you have an anecdotal memory, and was that something that you had naturally, or you learnt a form of telling stories?
That's a good question. I think if you're interested in hearing stories, that's the biggest part of the equation, because you go with it. And so you're right, there are jokes that are anecdotes that you go with the story, and then the punchline either lands or does the opposite thing or whatever, or surprises you. And sometimes it's again, going back to Laurel and Hardy, and in a visual sense, was when the bricks are falling on Oliver Hardy's head. You're waiting for the last one that is seconds later, which is when he looks up, and you're waiting for that. And there's a satisfaction with that.
Yeah. And that's storytelling too, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And I think the thing I suppose because I grew up thinking of jokes as those structured things, which were, three blokes walk into a bar. And because those weren't true, they're structured very well, is that I enjoyed them, of course, because they're funny. It's funny. But I could never tell them. Whereas for me, there was always a little journey through it, and that made it easier for me to kind of follow it. So, I think also because anecdotes don't have the pressure of being funny in the way that a joke does. If you kind of go, this is a joke, you sit back and you go, all right then. Whereas if it's a story, it can go anywhere and it can be poignant and it can be hilarious and it can be moving and it can be all those things in the same little journey. But also, Barry, you do both of those things, don't you? You kind of do anecdotes, which are stories, which are funny.
Yes.
And then sometimes you're just prompted to tell the joke.
The joke, yes. Yeah. I get primed a lot by people now. I had it yesterday in our pub. There was a gang of the old regulars all around the table, and I walked in and they just looked at me and went, joke. You know, I'm obliged to do it, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, like in record stores where you have a currently playing or now playing, where they put the cover next to the till. That's, you have a joke which is like that. It's like this week's joke that I will be telling everybody. Because it's the lady on the old lady on the train has been situ for a while. You know, the parrot, you went through a period of, a bit like Picasso with his blue period. You went through a parrot
jokes, No, I just latched on to parrots because they talk. You thought,
so you can tell animal jokes.
Yes, you can fit a parrot into any situation because he or she talks.
Can you give me an example?
Yes. Oh, the parrot joke, the definitive one, my favourite, yes.
I think we might have done that on another episode.
Yeah, well, I'll do another joke.
But hang it.
No, a guy said to his mate, my parrot's driving me mad, of foul language. And his mate said, stick him in the fridge for 5 minutes, he'll get the message. So he said to his parrot, you're going to stop swearing. And the parrot said, why don't you? So he got hold of it and stuck it in the fridge, closed the door, 5 minutes, took it out. You're going to stop swearing? And the parrot said, all right. And the parrot looked back in the fridge and said, what did that chicken do?
Very good. So, when you have that, someone shouts joke at you.
Yes.
What happens in your head? Do you swiftly go through a Rolodex, or do you just grab the first one that's coming to
you? The latest I've heard, or sometimes I say, give me a subject.
Oh, okay.
I want to home in on it a bit, not just...
That's why the comedy jukebox sort of label has stuck, I think.
I was defined once as an anecdote jukebox. Put the coin in and he tells you a relevant story or whatever.
I mean, if we're being a little less kind, we used to say it's because you're full of hits.
It was, certainly with the very few girlfriends I've had, one of the things that with my relationship with all of them was that they would kind of say, all right, tell me a story. And I'd say, well, give me a subject. And it would then be an anecdote. It would be whether it was mashed potato and I'd have something about that. Or
because were there people in your family who were great storytellers?
I think my mum's side of the family were all quite quick-witted. My father's side of the family were all slow-witted. So it was a strange meeting of wits. But it was, I think it was their side. There was a lot of talk. Well, that's the other thing, was that when you didn't have access to, you know, personal entertainment for 24 hours a day, you used to talk more. And so a lot of things emerged from that. And that's the thing that we do less of. I mean, it's interesting now that, you know, there's, I think quite rightly, there's a lot of focus on people talking because of mental health. You know, to kind of talk about how you feel and talk. But actually, just generally talking is good for your mental health. You know, sharing those anecdotes and the jokes and all the rest of it, because that's where perspective comes from.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and people are much more solitary and trying to get, you know, when you're, you know, incredibly angry or upset or worried or whatever, the thing you lose is perspective. And you need to talk to someone else to grab a little perspective. And I've always kind of said the advantage of being... having a humour head, is that irony gives you instant perspective. You look at that thing that's awful and you go, that is, oh my God, that's awful. And if you've, you know, you've got a weird, funny head, you look at it from another angle and you go, that's actually it's funny.
And visually in film, they talk about that, don't you? You know, tragedy in close-up and comedy is a wide shot.
Yeah, yeah. But if the fact that you then kind of understand, I think, intrinsically, that something can be absolutely terrible and absolutely hilarious at the same time. One is not taking it away from the other. They just coexist. And that's what I think the great advantage of, you know...
This is what...
Well, you always tell yourself off for making a joke when... If as a family we're having a serious discussion and you might throw a joke in.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it any less valid to the conversation because it might be giving a slightly different perspective on something quite difficult to talk about.
the juxtaposition of a horrible subject and humour.
Well, Ricky Gervais on Jerry Seinfeld, Comedian Cars Getting Coffee, tells a Holocaust joke. Do you
yes.
know that one?
Yeah.
And it was about the man at the pearly gates, wasn't it, talking about the Holocaust to St. Peter, to God, and saying, you know, it was terrible, but I do have a joke about it. He says, how can you have a joke about the Holocaust? He said, well, I guess you had to be there.
Mm. Oh, God. Oh. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, it's, you know, the sensitivity thing is because you can't cater for everyone's sensitivity at the same time. You know, you can talk, you can say a joke about a dog and you go, well, that's fairly safe, you know. And if there's one person who's just lost their dog, then to them it's going to mean something else. And you can't cater for that.
No.
But you can, you know, if you're sensitive enough, cater for the mood of the time.
Mm. But what I admire enormously, I'm often assumed to be Jewish, and a rabbi in Northwood called me honorary Jew. I was delighted. But maybe trace of Jewish, but I've loved Jewish humour and the way they fought back in the horror of what a lot of people had to go through, doggedly telling jokes. I can't.
Yeah, but I think you see, I'm the same, and so when Goodness Gracious Me came out, the Jewish Chronicle kind of said, well, these are really Jewish jokes, aren't they? I mean, we kind of like, and so they interviewed me for it. And I got half page in the Jewish Chronicle. And so I became honorary Jew at that point as well, yes. which I was delighted about. And I said, well, yeah, it's not surprising because, you know, those of us that were writing it were influenced so much by kind of Jewish humorists.
Yes.
You know, going back to the Marx Brothers.
And I didn't know that West Side Story, the musical, the two elements, it was about anti-Semitism originally, and they changed it subsequently.
Oh, really?
Is that right?
Yes.
What a whole different musical that would have been.
the other gang were Jewish in the original. It's fascinating looking back.
But that's also about a great art and great creativity is that,
yes.
you know, that we can all look at something like West Side Story and relate to some aspect of it because
yes.
it's a story well told. You know, you don't kind of go, well, I can't relate. I'm not Puerto Rican. But also, you know, pursuing the kind of, you know, the Jewish humorous thing was that the irony that goes through it and those kind of conundrums where, you know, that it goes back to so many of those old folktale, Jewish folktales, which kind of end up with a rabbi effectively going on the one hand and on the other hand, and it's kind of real and it's funny. And so I think it runs through their storytelling. And then when you go through their kind of history of persecutions of various kind, you kind of go that thread of storytelling, which had humor and heart to it,
yeah.
was always a part of it. And so again, it's going back to me kind of saying, you know, on a Saturday when I was a kid in the school holidays, you'd get the history of comedy by watching it for a day. And with that, you get that kind of history of where those humorists may have come from.
Absolutely. As you say, you get the immediately contemporary stuff in the evening.
Yeah.
And you're extrapolating from that. Oh, I see where the lineage of that.
Yeah.
And going back to basics, Alan Bennett said a sense of humour is a sense of proportion.
Oh, that's quite good.
Yeah. And you see it now in the political climate. They all think they must show they've got a sense of humour. And you think, you should have left that. Don't try a joke. Don't try the funny line because you can't
Unless you're Barack Obama and you could open for...
Yeah, yes, you
can. for someone.
Alan Johnson, who retired from politics and writes now, he's an author. I think he's one of the best leaders they never had because the man has got humour. Because I'm involved with the Oldie magazine and host the lunches. And Alan appeared twice, once for a book and once for the next book. And it was an audience of a certain age. And he stood up and said, well, here I am again. He said, I'll do exactly the stuff I did before because half of you have gone and the other half wouldn't remember.
That's very good.
And they laughed, you see. It, yeah. Also, somebody else saying that, they wouldn't have laughed. It's the persona of the person who's saying it. It's like two comedians can tell the same joke and the audience laugh at one comedian, not at the other. It's who it's coming from.
People always kind of related that again because Jewish humour was so influential, I suppose, was that they always say, well, you know, only Jewish people can tell Jewish jokes. And I think the reason for that is that you kind of, you get, one assumes that the Jewish person telling the Jewish joke has no hatred of Jews. You know, so there's a different timbre to it than someone saying it, the same joke, but saying it with a harsher tone or a kind of, you know.
I'd be regarded as presumptuous telling a Jewish joke, wouldn't I, really? And I'm telling it admiringly as a fan of Jewish humour.
No, but you're very good because you always attribute. So like, you know, anecdote storytelling, but you always have a story about how you heard that joke and then tell the joke because you get the best of both worlds. Then.
Yeah, yeah.
I mentioned Louis Lippmann. Yeah. My introduction to Jewish humour was at school. And there was a guy who became a friend of mine, Louis Lippmann, and a Jewish boy. And the master of one class said, maths master, Lippmann, what's 10% of 52 pounds? And he said, exactly, sir, what's 10%? And the master laughed. And I thought, boy, you're interesting. That was a wonderful, that was my introduction, really, to Jewish humour, Louis Lippmann.
But any US comedy you would have been listening to on the radio was almost, you know, certainly written by Jewish writers and performers at that time.
I mean, right through, you know, from the Marx Brothers and, you know, 29, I think, was their first, I think Coconuts, I think, was 1929. So that's incredibly early in terms of sound, isn't
it?
And, but, you know, through to the Billy Wilder stuff, which is, and the I.L. Diamond written stuff, which is extraordinary. And then through into the 60s
but where... Broadway and Hollywood, loaded Jewish writers and... Amazing.
But particularly in terms of influencing comedy, because, you know, particularly film and then television became what we, you know, digested. I mean, that's what we were...
The emigration from the Nazis as well. They were leaving and going to the States, you know, and it was the States' win. What a... Those brilliant people. Irving Berlin could hardly speak English when he arrived in America.
Actually, Billy Wilder couldn't. Initially,
and
the complexity in the comedy, just in the comedy writing of his stuff, is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, whether it's across Some Like It Hot, which I still think is a work of genius, but you know, across The Apartment or any of those things, it's amazing.
Is that one of your Desert Island movies? Have you had to?
I think certainly Some Like It Hot is, because I think it almost has everything I love in a film.
Oh, it's brilliant
because you've got, you know, you've got Marilyn Monroe, who I never looked more kind of vulnerable and cute and beautiful and sexy. And then you had Jack Lemmon, who was just an acting hero of mine. He could just do everything.
Oh,
and the premise is great. You know, and it's now, even if I'm trying to look at it through 21st century eyes, but the idea of two men having to dress up as women, there's no point within the film that I can think of now where they're demeaning women in any way.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that's, given when it was written, that'd be quite an easy thing to do, but they didn't do that. That's extraordinary. I think the music's fantastic. I love the soundtrack. You know,
she even got a punchline right at the end.
I mean, just...
The whole movie has a punchline.
Genius.
Yeah.
That punchline.
They were
genius.
Just talking, saying, how are we going to end this? They weren't even mad at choosing that line, and it's become... That's a legend.
And that's a Python-esque thing to do, isn't it? Just to say, I don't know how we're going to end it, but...
Yeah, yeah. No, it's fantastic.
Shrug it off.
I think it's a work of genius. I really do. I mean, there are other comedy films that I think are great and mean something to me. But, I mean, even something like... which vies in my head for my favourite film of all time, with Some Like It Hot, is A Matter of Life and Death.
Oh, God,
and, it's genuinely really funny.
Yes.
At times. And you go, okay, then give it, you know, the subject matter.
Well, there's all the stuff in heaven with all the different, you know.
It's fantastic. It's brilliant.
Flying Officer Trubshaw and all that. And then you have the Marius Goring, whatever that accent is.
Yeah, whatever that accent is, yeah.
He's just absolutely loving every second of that.
But it's an incredibly profound film about affirming life and affirming love. And yet it's really funny.
I'd put that in a double bill with It's a Wonderful Life. I like watching those two together because they speak a lot to each other in terms of the visitor from heaven and, you know, the sort of having a second chance and all of those things.
Did you see any of those films at the cinema?
Yes, I think I saw Some Like It Hot in the cinema.
You'd just come to London by then, hadn't you?
Yeah. Back in Leeds, I remember seeing Rocket Ship XM which was the first science fiction film. Oh, and Barnard Devil, which was the first terrible film, but 3D. You wore glasses. Oh, right. a lover in your arms, a lion in your lap.
But also literal.
Yeah.
And somebody then was doing the joke, sitting in the cinema with the glasses on, and the guy next to him sitting, and he turns to the guy next to him and says, "Are you enjoying this film?" He said, "I'm in it."
Because that's the other thing. Like with the when I first bought, you know, a large screen, it was like a plasma screen at that time. And, you know, I'd never experienced a TV this big. It's a TV. And actually the first thing I did was watch old films I'd never seen on a screen that big. So the Laurel and Hardys and the Some Like It Hots and stuff like that. And I played that. And it felt like I was discovering them for the first time. Suddenly at that scale, suddenly seemed to fit. Yes. How great these films were.
Because you're then seeing the whole background and how that's, yes, you know, adding to
Buster Keaton as a projectionist
chaos.
Who gets up and walks into the film on the screen in a cinema. Have you seen that?
Sounds familiar.
He walks. He's a projectionist.
Right.
But he gets fascinated by this film and he climbs onto the screen and gets into the film.
How bloody inventive is that? Boy. I mean, it's
Purple,
brilliant.
Purple Rose of Cairo, isn't it? In reverse.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Stepping
brilliant.
Into it. But it's amazing how, you know, look, that's the thing now, because it's not as available. The problem with it being on the internet is you have to find it. It isn't presented to you, which TV kind of still does. But that was the great thing about watching all those silent films and early talkies, is you just kind of realize just quite how inventive they were. I remember, for me, Modern Times and City Lights, the two Chaplin films, I think took silent film as far as it could go. I mean, I think they're just so extraordinary in their storytelling.
What interests me, Sanjeev, I don't know whether you've noticed, I never laugh at Charlie Chaplin. I just think you're brilliant.
Right.
It doesn't make me laugh, and there's no way around it. Nobody could convince me I should be laughing. It's like if you tell a joke and somebody doesn't laugh, explaining it to them, no, leave it. The debate's over. Respect, you didn't laugh. I think it's funny you do. I've rarely laughed at Charlie Chaplin, but I think he's brilliant.
You've just reminded me there were some sketches that I wrote for Goodness Gracious Me, which were the Asian parents who never got the joke.
Yes.
Do you remember it? I'm amazed.
I remember the parents, yes.
And it was the son who kind of giggles and the parents go, "What is it?" He goes, "Oh, I just thought somebody told me a joke today." And they go, tell us. And he goes, "Well, no, it's a silly joke." They go, "We like jokes, tell us." And he goes, "All right then." So he goes, there's this three-legged chicken. And the dad goes, "Well, I don't believe that." And he goes, "What?" He goes, "I don't believe there's a three-legged chicken. I've never seen one." He goes, "No, it's part of the joke. It's kind of, all right." So anyway, there's a three-legged chicken, and this bloke says to the farmer, you know, "How does it taste?" And he goes, "Well, that's wrong." He said, "If you've got something as unique as a three-legged chicken, the last thing you should be doing is butchering it." It was just that. The shortened version that we then did, a subsequent one, was the son comes in. It still makes me laugh. It shouldn't make me laugh. It's my own bloody joke. But the son comes in, and he goes, "Knock, knock." And the dad just goes, "I'll get it." It's the parents that never got
well
the
in a nice piece of kismet, you know, to wrap up all of our themes and all of our topics. That is my life in reverse, because my father obviously would, you were talking about the go-to joke for you was always the cockerel, which I don't think's been told on a microphone by you for a while.
Yeah,
but you dig out every now and again.
You've got to remind me of it.
There's a man driving down a country road.
Oh, that's right.
There you go.
Do you know what? Sorry, can I just say that was like a push start?
I've got him in second gear.
My sunstroke carer. Man driving down a country lane ran over a cockerel and he was rather upset. And the farmhouse was close by. And he went and knocked on the door. A woman came and he said, I appear to have killed your cockerel. I'd like to replace him. She said, "Please yourself, the hen's around the back."
This is kind of like...
You've got another one loaded.
Oh, go on, then. Go on, fire away.
This elephant went into a pub. Oh, that would never happen.
Now, this is, I mean, I don't, you know, this is kind of an addendum, really, but this is just, and just so because, you know, there's people here and it's in public. But Barry, you are, I mean, really, there is no one like you. It's kind of how encouraging you are across the board is just extraordinary.
Because I was encouraged. Frank Muir and Dennis Norton, who wrote, you know, Take It From Here and Radio, they never patronised me. They just treated you as a fellow writer. I never forgot that. You were just their mate, like them, a script writer.
Goldman and Simpson.
Goldman Simpson were a few years older than me, not much. They were just the same. I never forgot that. And I think instinctively, when I started meeting younger ones, I thought, I've got to repay this.
Well, Michael Palin and Eric Idle both said you were Uncle Baz because you were the first person in that Methodist hall when you were meeting for the Frost Report that came over to say hello and said come and join us.
We're all new here. I said, oh, that was great. We played football with a tennis ball with Frost as the goalkeeper. When we'd had the meeting, it was like, no, I called
with no disrespect to anything that's gone before.
So let me just recap on that.
I didn't even know that.
So you were playing football with a tennis ball.
Yes.
David Frost was in goal. And who else was playing? I mean, who was?
We're just a gang of
writers.
It does
sound like there's a punchline.
Yeah. There was a whole gang of writers. No, there's no title in the story.
Who was the best footballer?
Oh, I don't remember. It didn't
matter. No, we really need to know.
Yeah, that's kind of. How good a goalie was David Frost?
Marty Feldman, Twinkle Toes, yeah, could have played for Stoke.
Prognosis, I called him a practicing catalyst. Frost was brilliant with people. He'd noticed Graham Chapman and I become mates, and Graham always wrote with John Cleese. But Graham and I had never thought of writing together. And we got together, we wrote together a lot of stuff. And John Cleese would say, are you being unfaithful to me with Baz?
Well, you wrote with Cleese very briefly and decided it just wasn't going to work.
We just decided it wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
I wanted to write the sketch very quickly, go, no, we can do better than that, and then bin it. And John wanted to analyse every line as you went along.
Mm-hmm.
So we were friends. We said, this isn't working, you know. You've got to have a rapport when you're writing with somebody.
Have you always written with a partner or...?
I've never written with a partner.
Oh, right.
And it is... it's a weird, difficult headspace because the level of arrogance that you have to feel to say, I've just thought of this, and I think millions of people are going to laugh at this, is a weird headspace because you start to question it as well. That's the problem with the analysing thing is you can go, oh, well, actually, I know, the 10th time of reading it, I'm not sure if it's funny.
I never wrote alone subsequently. Always bagging it about. I wrote Danny LaRue, who had a famous nightclub. I wrote that show on my own. That's the last time I worked alone. Oh, and the heckler.
What, at Danny's?
Yes, very quickly. We'd have the band would play a tune, then we'd have the opening number. Then I was in the show as well. And I'd go on and do a sort of warm-up to kick the show off. And I told one joke, and a voice in the darkness said, this is satire, I suppose. And I said, no, it's nightclub filth. You should get out more. Got a laugh. It's John Lennon. I was heckled by John Lennon.
Wow.
That's a pathetic boast, isn't it? And then subsequently is with
Yoko. That's the one thing I didn't say, by the way, is you both met your wives whilst working through comedy. Because my mum is a singer, dancer at Danny LaRue's club. Which is,
you worked
together before you became a couple.
Best thing that ever happened to me was meeting her. I was sat standing next to the piano. I met my wife the very same day I met Ronnie Corbett. Tossed a coin and married her. Oh, boy. Ronnie said to me one day, he said, I don't know what rung of the ladder you're on, Baz, but stay there. He said, you're always around, but nobody's pointing at you. I'm the peripheral figure, the straight man, the co-writer, the all over the place, the warm-up man.
Also, do you know, I have to say, probably one of the warmest, actually, that I've met.
Oh,
and it's true. And do you know what it is?
Thank you.
No need to thank me, it's the truth. And because I think that, particularly with comedians, there are those comedians, one assumes all comedians want to make people laugh, but there are those who also want to be made to laugh.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, There's, and that suddenly divides that very large group into a much smaller one. But in terms of the warmth and encouragement, I don't know anyone else who's been as consistent across the board.
That is one of the greatest privileges of when I tell people who my dad is and they recognise the surname. The first thing they do is smile, because you have a very positive effect on
I love people laughing, and it doesn't have to be me who makes them laugh. Graham Garden, my old friend, said, oh, Baz needs an audience. And I'd say, I prefer Baz needs people.
Yeah, it's like a social.
I'm terminally gregarious. And I love laughing. I don't care where it doesn't have to be me making them laugh. And I'd want a conversation as well. I'm not just telling jokes, you know. I'm a peopleaholic. I'm not a workaholic.
Well, are we being thrown out of here?
I mean, I just never know when to press stop.
No, I know.
Well, we did finally work out when to press stop. It was just as the bell went for last orders. The tube stopped running, and the landlord physically threw us out. If you've enjoyed Now Where Were We, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review, subscribe to the show, and yes, tell your friends. Thank you so much to everyone who's done so already and left such kind words. It really does help us to find listeners who might otherwise miss the show. So until next time, when we'll be sitting down with Giles Brandreth, from my father and myself, goodbye and thank you for listening.